They don't know how much time is to come, whether it is wind or rain or sleet or snow. You're always here. And you are the Starkers. It's good. It's impressive. Okay, we're on 37A1. Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, the top of the page. Remember that we are reading about the shape of the Sanhedrin, the shape in which the Sanhedrin sits. And we read so far that the Sanhedrin sits in a semicircle.
Sanhedrin?
No, also the Gedolah. Also sits the same. 71 people in a semicircle, correct. All in a semicircle. Although that wasn't our main concern here. Our main concern was the 23. And we read that there was one opinion that there were two recording secretaries, another opinion that there were three. But we did see that the proceedings had to be recorded in case of any dispute, and that we would be able to have a written record of what was to be the Edim had testified. Now we go a little bit further to see the way. Not only was the group sitting in a semicircle, the shalosh shurot shel talmidei chachamim yoshvim lefneihem. There were three rows of disciples. Excuse me. So we've been talking about the judges, right? A court of 23. But interestingly enough, in a capital case, they sat not only by themselves, but with three rows of judges in front of them. I'm sorry, not in front of them, a total of three rows. Three rows of Talmidei Chachamim, of sages, would sit before them. Kol echad v'echad makir et mekomo. Each one recognizing his place. Now let's see what this means. Let's first of all read the Rashi. Rashi, which is right at the top of the page in the Rashi, so just go immediately to the left, and as soon as you see the block Hebrew letters and then the Rashi script, Vishalosh Shurot, three rows of Talmidei Chachamim are in front of the court itself. Kol Echad Kiminyan Sanhedri Esrim Ushlosha. Every row had the same number of people as in the small Sanhedrin of 23. She'im yach leku hakaf gimel. For if there will be a difference of opinion among the 23, ruban mechayvim, the majority declares the person to be guilty. Umiut mizakin, and the minority declare him to be not guilty. Vehataya l'ra'a ein al pi echad. But it is not possible to make a decision for guilty with only a majority of one. Okay, we've already learned that. So here we have a case where there is a majority to convict, but it's a majority of one. And you are not allowed to convict for guilty in a capital crime with a majority of one. So what do you do in that case? Sarich lahosif shnayim shnayim. You add two more judges. And this is described in a later Mishnah. You add two more judges. And you then repoll. And if, let's say, you come out, you've added another two judges, and you continue to only have a majority of one, okay? What do you do then? You add another two judges. You can add as many as until you finally get to a maximum of 71. Okay? And that's what Lohosif shnayim shnayim ad shivim biachad. So you go two by two until you reach a maximum of 71. Hilkach. So where do you get those extra judges from?
Three rows.
Okay, from the three rows that are in front of you. From the three rows that are in front of you. Okay? Hilkach sarich lahoshiv lifnehem arba'im ushmone lahashlamat shivim v'achat. Therefore, you have to seat in front of you 48 people. Why? Because we started with 23. Right, if we start with 23, we have a maximum of 71. So you have to seat 48 people in front of you. But there's a problem with the number 48. Rashi describes it. Okay? V'lav orach ara la'asot shurot le'talmidim shel kaf dalet. All right, if you're going to have 48, the natural thing to do would be to have two rows of 24. Okay? But it isn't appropriate. Lo orach ara. Orach ara means derech eretz. How would you say derech eretz here? I said appropriate. It doesn't look nice. It doesn't feel right to set up rows of 24. Why? Because the judges themselves are 23. So you are setting up a physical environment where the Talmidei Chachamim, all right, the students of the sages, in fact appear to have more power than the sages themselves. So that's inappropriate. All right? See here, the lav orach ara la sot shurot the talmidim shall kaf dalet. It's not appropriate to have rows of the students of 24 shetehe merube mishal dayanim, because that makes them larger than the judges themselves. The lola sot shurot katanot. Nor would it be appropriate to do small groups such as below shtayim shel kaf gimel. Another possibility is two rows of 23. All right, that gives you 46. The echad shel shnayim, and one of two. One row of two, you can do that too. All right. Hilkach, therefore, in order to avoid all of these possibilities, avde shalosh shurot, we have then three rows, of people of 23. So even though we're not going to use all of them, that's the compromise that's finally made in order to create an environment where it just seems appropriate. The chol echad makir et mekomo. Did we read that? Chol echad makir et mekomo, yes. Okay, let's read that in the Rashi. Everyone, each one knows his place. Lefisha bitchila, because to begin with, kaseder hoshivam shura rishona gedola mishel shnia. They are seated in such a way that the first row of Talmidei Chachamim includes the people who are more important, more knowledgeable, more learned than the second row of Talmidei Chachamim. The higadola mina shlishit, and the second row is of more prominent people than the third row. V'gam b'chol shura b'shura, as well in each and every row, hoshivum keseder hagadol barosh. All right, the people were seated so that the most learned of the people was in the chief seat. Right? He's in the chief seat. Sheni Lamata, the number two person, was then in the seat next to him. Right? Going down the row. The Chen Kulan, Ze Lamata Mize. And that's how it proceeded, one after the other, one below the other. Lefichach, Tzarich Kol Echad Lahakir Mekomo. Therefore, everybody has to know where to sit. Okay, because there was a very strict arrangement of how people sat.
How do we reconcile that with what we were talking about last year, with honoring the elders? Because there, It seems to me, the diminishment of the elder is the person has lost capacity and demoted the person in the seat.
When it gets to functionality, there's a different definition of elder. The very word, even in English, really is the same as the Hebrew. It's a problem in the Hebrew. How do you say elder in Hebrew? Zaken. Zaken. And how do you say a rabbi in Hebrew? Another, one way to say is zaken. Okay? So the Talmud has to ask, who is a zaken? Is it somebody who is old or somebody who is wise? We said it in Kiddushin. That was in Kiddushin. So that's the basic problem. And of course, there's no resolution to that problem except by functionality. Namely, where it matters, in fact, status according to wisdom, in fact, does matter. And that's in this case. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Hutzrahulismoch. If the judges needed to ordain someone, somchim mina rishona, they would ordain from one of the disciples of the first row. Of the first row. Echad mina shnia balo la rishona. And then somebody who is in the second would go to the first. Echad mina shlishit bala shnia. Somebody who is in the third would go to the second. Okay? Finally, Borerin Lahem Od Echad Minakahal. They would then choose one person from the community. Umoshivino Tobashlishit. And they would seat him in the third row. The Loayayoshe Bimakomoshal Rishon. He would not sit in the place of the first one who had left the row, Eliyoshe b'makoma ra'uilo, but would sit in the place that was appropriate for him. Okay, let's go back to the Rashi. Hutzrachu lismoch, if they had to ordain. Now remember, we did deal with this last year, the ordination of judges, that when it gets down to the court of 23, those judges have to be ordained. And it was an issue that we raised even in the court of three, whether you needed ordained people or not, and that was an issue. But in the court of 23, there's no question about it. You need somebody who is of high level of knowledge, and the ordination procedure presupposes that. It gives you a way of judging the judge's competence. Okay? So hutzrachulis moch, if they need to ordain somebody, kagon, such as, now this is interesting, because what is raised here is a slightly different situation than we might have expected. We originally set this up in terms of, you've got a court of 23, you can't get a majority of two to convict, and so we have to add twos, we have to add them by twos. Here, hutzrachu litzmoch, Rashi raises another different problem. Kagon shemet echad min hadayanim. Such as if one of the judges were to die. Now that's always possible. That certainly could happen. Or, you know, less than that, one of the judges could get sick. Right? And have to excuse himself from the procedure. So what do we say then if a judge has to excuse himself for some reasonable matter like that? Do we simply operate with a court that's a smaller court? We don't. You always have to have a court of 23. So you have to feed then into the court to fill that place. Okay. It's much the same, by the way, if any of you have been, probably most of you have been on jury duty. It's a simple, you, when they make a jury, everybody has a place. There, it's the place is determined simply by the place of your election, as it were, where you're being chosen. You get that place for that reason. You have to sit in that place. This is somewhat different. This is according to status. So, utzrachu lismoch, kagon shemet echad min hadayanim, such as if one of the judges died, somchim lo min harishonim shehem gedolim mikulam, then they ordain somebody from the first row who is the most prominent of them all. So we have fixed seating here. From the chief to the least of the people in each row. So we start with the person who is Barishon. Echad mi'ashni'a ba'lo la'rishona. Somebody from the second row comes to the first. V'lo she'yaviu mina kahal la'rishona. We don't invite somebody who is just in the general community to come into the first row. Well, what we do is we have musical chairs. Everybody moves one seat. Everybody has to move one seat. Lefisha hagorea min atalmidim shabashurot gadol migadol shabakahal. The assumption is that the least person who is sitting in the third row, in the last seat of the third row, is more learned than any of the people who's not in any of those rows. So we can't take somebody from the general group and replace the one who, you know, and replace the missing one. Rather, it starts, it's all in this order, and it has to go according to the order, and then everybody moves up one if we have to replace somebody.
The most distinguished person is in the middle of the row?
Because
last time, didn't it say that it's
no,
at the end?
No, that's the judge is the most important.
Yes, that's good. That's correct. We're not talking about the judges.
So here
we're talking about the fillers.
We're talking about the fillers, right. We're talking about the fillers. The fillers are not the most important person in the center, but it starts at one side, whatever that side is, and it goes to the other side. Okay?
It looks like
because otherwise it would be very complicated.
Yeah, that's what I was worried about.
Very exactly. If it's just musical chairs, then everybody moves one seat. It's much easier to actually do that.
It looks there is a conflict in the design of the courtroom, because if you allow to grow up to 71 judges, that means that the circle, the semicircle, need to be wide enough for 71,
correct,
which they're not talking about.
Correct, they're not talking
wide about. Enough for 71, 24 can be easily... seats, so there is a conflict by the design.
Well, they would have to add seats in order to have to add seats in the
yeah,
main
but then,
group.
Then, but they said that the 24 is too big because it's more than the 23. But if they put immediately 71, the 24 can easily fit the semicircle.
But we make the law not for the unusual case, but for the common case. Generally speaking, that's not what happens in the court, but you need always to have the extras who are there in case they're needed.
Right. And it never reached the 71 poll.
Well, this I couldn't tell you, but at least it's a theoretical possibility. Okay? Anyone else? Okay. Let's see, was there more Rashi there? Okay. Go back to the Mishnah. Let's just do the last two lines of the Mishnah. Below Ayah Yosheb B'Makom Arishon, he would not sit in the place of the first one, the disciple who had left that row. Ella Yosheb B'Makom Ra'uilo, rather he would sit in the place appropriate for him, namely in the last seat. Okay, you don't fill in the empty seat. Rather, everybody moves up one seat, and then the last seat becomes vacant. Right. So let's read the Rashi. V'lo aya. Oto shenivrar mina kahal. The person who is chosen from the community at large. Yoshev bimakomo shel rishon rosh shebushura shlishi. He would not sit in the place of the first person who is in the third row. Ela b'makom ha-ra'ui lo basof hashura, but the place that is appropriate for him at the end of the row. Echein oto sheba min ha-shlishi la-shniya. Likewise, for the person who comes from the third row to the second row, echein oto shenismach min ha-rishonim v'lo aya yoshev b'makom moshal rishon. Similarly, for the people who come from the first row, or the people who are in the first row, he would not sit b'mekol moshal rishon, wouldn't sit in the place of the first one. Ela kulam b'sof hashurot. Everybody moves to to the end of the road that is ahead of him. V'chol b'nei ha-shura nimshachim ish ish l'mala mimakomo. All the people in a row would move then one over. Where is that? I lost my place. Umimalin, they fill then Zemekomo shel zeh. They each fill the place of the person who's in front of them. Mipnei shehakatan shebedayanim gadol min hagadol shebetalmidei harishona. Because the smallest of the lowest of the judges themselves, that's to say the 23, who are actually judges, is greater than the greatest of the Talmidim who are in the first row, and the students in the first row. Da'akatan shebarishona, and the least of the people in the first row, is gadol min hagadol shebishniya, is greater than the greatest, than the most important person in the second row. Okay? Hilkach, ki naide kulhu naide. Oh, when they move, they all move. Right? So that's what happens. When one moves, they all move. Kishemet echad mehem, when in a case where, for example, one of the judges dies, umoshivim acher chalifav, and they have to replace him. They have to move a replacement in for him. Kulam tzrichim lanud ish ish mimakomo. Everybody has to move, each from his place. Okay.
Rabbi, how would the judges decide who was most what? Probably that was when they skipped out. Or, I mean, they probably didn't take standardized tests.
It's an interesting. It happens to be an extremely interesting and an important question because it's also relevant today. It's actually the same question is asked today. What is the source of rabbinic authority? Because we, in our own time,
Sorry.
It's pretty music.
I'm very interested in your answer.
Okay. An article was written on the subject. It was in Judaism magazine many years ago by Rabbi Aaron Kirschenbaum. Aaron Kirschenbaum, who was a professor in the seminary, he then went on to become a professor in Tel Aviv University, professor of law in the law school at Tel Aviv U. And Kirschenbaum wrote an article, because this is fascinating. He graduated from the seminary, and the more he got involved, he decided that he had to get from. Seminary wasn't from enough for him. So he went to Yeshiva University. This must have been early 60s when this was going on, early 60s. So he went to Yeshiva University. He also got snicha from Yeshiva. And then he decided he would come back to the seminary because he would then be sort of an anchor in the seminary. He would be somebody who was in that community who you could trust. And he would be a good influence on the students. And Finkelstein was very supportive of that. Then chancellor of the seminary, really felt that they had to have in the faculty solid people whose lives, behavior, and knowledge were not in question. He then kept many people off the faculty. We had several different faculties. We had a faculty of the rabbinical school, and then we had a faculty for everybody else. To teach in the rabbinical school, you had to demonstrate your piety. This is my time. Such things no longer exist. Piety is no longer a qualification for anything in that world.
What's the definition of piety?
I can't define it. Right? It would be too long and difficult to define. But it had to do with level of observance as well as the inner life. Certainly, it certainly was a level of observance. So he was always toying with these jurisprudential ideas. Eventually became a professor of that. He left this whole world, went on Aliyah, and became his professor at Tel Aviv. So he wrote an article in Judaism. Of course, this ancient history, that no longer exists either. Judaism magazine, you can get in libraries. When my books get opened someday, they're now in boxes somewhere in this building. I'm going to donate all my old copies. They'll be in this library if we can ever find room for them. So I have journals that go way back. That's valuable in a library because nobody has journals. They don't have old copies of journals. I always kept journals. So I have old copies of Judaism magazine way back into the 70s. I have a few complete. I have the Journal of Medical Ethics. I have a complete from the first edition of the Journal of Medical Ethics. So someday that's going to be, or is a Ruiz legacy. I have no place to keep them, and so I can't deal with this. So if it will be of any interest to the congregants that can have it. So he wrote this article on the nature of rabbinic authority. And he had been this route. The reason I give you all this background is he had in his own life taken this route. By that time in his life, he sent his schools to the yeshivas Chofetz Chaim. Any of you know the Chofetz Chaim on the west side? It's right across from, I don't know if it's still there, I think it's still there, from the memorial, from Riverside, it's Riverside and 89th, I think, or something like that, is the Chofetz Chaim yeshiva. So he sent his kids there. In a classic Baal Tshuva type of married a very firm woman, and every time I would ask him a question kashered, he would say, I don't deal with those things, I ask my wife. She was came from a very distinguished rabbinic family, and he really made it because in the Chofetz Chaim Yeshiva, which was, in those days, we didn't yet have a term called Haredi. There was no such thing as Haredi in the 70s. Of course there were, but there was no words calling them that, so you didn't have such a name. They were Misnagdim and Hasidim. So this was a Misnagdish yeshiva. It was always interesting if you were around that neighborhood on the west side, because they looked like Hasidim. And for those of us who were not familiar with this world, the Hasidim and the Misnagdim dressed the same way. Or they wore long coats, and that was just classical dress. If you spend time in Israel, you know this is still the case. In this country, it's changed a fair amount. But he finally was so respected by the Chofetz Chaim Yeshiva and by its community that he would daven Ne'ilah in the Chofetz Chaim. So they chose him to daven. That was the level of his piety, that they trusted him on Yom Kippur. So he researched the nature of rabbinic authority. And it's an extremely interesting question, because we have nobody to make those decisions. Who decides whose opinions will be respected? And the answer is nobody. There is no authority. And that's, in a way, the beauty of our system, as well as its major flaw. The Catholic Church, for example, figured that out, and they have a different system. Because they have a system of a hierarchical authority, where the one at the top appoints the one beneath them. And they have a whole system of appointees. And they have clear methodology for deciding who sits where. We don't have that. Probably in their time, in the time of the rabbis, there was some system. Probably it was the discretion of the chief judge, or it was a matter of consensus, as well as probably the stronger input of some people, who in any consensus environment, some people wield more power than other people. You know, we say consensus, but the reality is that in any group, consensus is made more by some people than by others, because their opinion is more respected. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but that's how most groups that function by consensus actually work. In modern rabbinics, we have less structure. We have no Sanhedrin at all. And after 1967, there was some interest in starting a Sanhedrin again. And that died very quickly, because it was so impractical. There was some reason for it, and that's actually going to come up very shortly here, because the Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin that decides issues, major issues of law, has to sit on the Temple Mount.
Agazit,
right. Has to sit on the Temple Mount. The first time that became practical was 1967. Right? After the Six-Day War, that became a practical possibility, and therefore the question was asked. Of course, had it been pursued, it was immediately shown as being impractical. It had nothing to do with the Arabs, though. That was never the issue. It never got that far. It was shown as impractical because of the Jews. It was impossible to decide who would be in the Sanhedrin. So at this stage of the game, we can't make those decisions. There's no communal structure to make those decisions. So Kirshenbaum, though, in his article, what was fascinating to me was that he made it very clear that it is entirely the consensus of the community that is the source of rabbinic authority. It's the consensus of the community. And that's really very important. It's really very important because certain groups try to achieve another level of hierarchy, and I believe that they cannot succeed. For example, we do it in the conservative movement. The conservative movement tries to achieve a structural hierarchy. Namely, we have a committee on Jewish law and standards of the Rabbinical Assembly. Okay? That committee, to my mind, is non-functional. I don't believe that anything that committee says today can be trusted, because there's no format for choosing the members, and there's no ability to achieve consensus. What happened was, and this happened to us 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, when the issue of the gay rabbis came up, what happened was, you had enough of an opinion so that it became a reasonable opinion of the committee, at which point all the people who disagreed quit the committee. Last year, this issue came up again. Last year, this issue came up again because the Rabbinical Assembly issued a liturgy for performing gay marriages. So I call up, I get this thing, so they have a liturgy. So I call up the people that I trust on the committee. And I said, how could you let this happen? So the rabbi said to me, he says, oh, you forgot? We're not on the committee. We quit. So that's the way these things work. After this, originally, this thing happened, I was appointed to be on a subcommittee to reform the Rabbinical Assembly's committee. So, I this is a subcommittee. They formed a subcommittee. The president of the Rabbinical Assembly. So, let me tell you what happens to this committee. I'm just giving you an example to tell you what actually happens. So I get there'll be other subcommittees. So we go around the committee with six, and I'm appointed by the president of the Rabbinical Assembly, because he tries, of course, to do this to get different points of view. You know, people who are generally respected, but not of one point of view, of a variety of points of view.
But there are women rabbis, not
this. So women rabbis, men rabbis, that's, these days you have to make sure that you cover all your bases. So I have a point of view, and that is, our point of view is that the committee should be disbanded. No, the committee. No, the committee. The committee.
Your view is that the committee should disband
the committee. Correct. So it should disband. Now, there's a reason. I explain the reason. Because I took the point of view that the only way to achieve any authority in the rabbinic community is the consensus of the community. Therefore, what we should have is a committee of experts, not a committee of people who ever are allowed to vote. You never vote on anything. You can't vote on anything, because that gives the idea that there is a right answer and a wrong answer. Rather, I said you should have a committee of experts, and the experts would each issue their opinion. Each issue their opinion, and then over time, the opinions that are more acceptable to the community will be the opinions that govern. And there should be no structure whatsoever beyond the choosing of the people who would be in the committee. Now, I know the argument against me. The argument against me is, well, how could you have a conservative movement? Because you have to define where the edges of the movement are. Well, who's in and who's out? And I answer to that, I don't agree. I don't think there should be an in or there should be an out. I don't care who's in and I don't care who's out. And I've been a conservative rabbi my whole life, and I don't know that the people in my congregation are very different from the people in the next congregation, even if they're called something different. I think that these distinctions are meaningless. So get rid of the distinctions. Well, so you can see, I was really an important member of this committee. You can imagine how much they liked what I had to say. Now, I'm not the only nut on the committee. One person after another has a point of view. None of us agreed with anybody else. So what happened was that this committee died. The subcommittee died. Subcommittee died. So nobody heard of its death, because they just hushed up the whole thing, because we just couldn't come to any consensus, and it just, the subcommittee died. It was impossible to reform the Rabbinical Assembly, and what's going to happen now is that, in my opinion, I said to them, the movement is just going to splinter slowly. It'll take time. It may take a generation, but it's just going to, there will in effect be two movements. There'll be some sort of orthodoxy, and it will have its edges, and then there will be the liberal movement. There will, in due time, be no conservative movement. So you heard it here first, but these were the seditious predictions that yours truly said. Going back to your question, I told you this is an important issue, in my opinion. Rabbinic authority, I think, is only gained through the community's respect. And I don't know of any way to legislate that. I don't know of any way to appoint it. And in fact, the place in the Jewish community where that works best, and it is functioning today, is in the Orthodox world. The Orthodox world, that's exactly how the Orthodox world works. The Orthodox world works by certain rabbis, and it's not a clean system here. I mean, it's not a great system, but it is a system that functions. People move up. Like a few weeks ago, it was about two months ago, Rabbi Eliashiv died. Rabbi Eliashiv was the chief Haredi rabbi in Israel. right now there is nobody has moved into his place, and I don't know what is going to happen there, but you can never predict these things. You really don't know. Sometimes it ends up being a movement within a family. It moves a little bit like kingship moves. So sometimes that's the movement. That's how it moves in the Hasidic world. The leadership moves like that. But that doesn't always work too. More and more these days, those movements break down too. And you had that in Brooklyn. You had Schneerson, you had a fight in.
They still have.
Correct. There's in.
They have two.
And they're always having legal battles.
In Lubavitch, the Lubavitch Rebbe died, there was no way to. No one could succeed him.
Because
it just didn't work.
He never designated a successor.
That's right. I think I told you the story a while ago of the rabbi who is the rabbi of the old city, Rabbi Nebenzahl. Rabbi Nebenzahl is aged now. He still is teaching, but he's showing his age. So he realized that he needed to be another rabbi to succeed him. So you know how he decided. What kind of search committee they had. He decided that if they had a search committee, it would destroy the community. That the only way to keep the community together is for him to appoint the successor. Okay? And the strange thing is that he's right. I mean, you may not like this, but he's right. He's right. Had there been a search committee, the whole community would have fallen apart. The community would have fallen apart. I know this community. And you know who he appointed?
His son.
He appointed his son. He appointed his son. Okay.
But in the Talmud it says that you cannot take the rabbi's son to follow the father.
Where does it say that?
I don't know. No, you know. I don't know.
You got to find it. I mean, it's not certain that the son will follow, but that is one of the ways that sometimes, it doesn't always work this way, but I'm just telling you, this just happened. I was introduced to his son, this is a month ago. I had attended one of, I'm sitting there, this is Som Gedalia. Som Gedalia, I go to Mincha, at the Ramban Shul in the old city, and it gets to the end of Mincha, and Mincha is long on the fast day, the Torah reading of a Haftorah, so I wanted to be in that synagogue, so I went to the synagogue, get to the end of Mincha, ends, and suddenly somebody starts teaching. I figure, well, my wife expects me home, right? I have a chance to hear somebody teach Talmud, I'm going to go. So I have no idea who this was. I only found out subsequently that this was the son. This was the son who had just recently been appointed to succeed his father. So I heard him give a shiur, a very learned guy, a young guy. First I couldn't believe that this was the son of that old guy, because this guy in his 30s, his father is well in his 70s, so it's all possible, but it just threw me for a loop for a minute, because I was expecting something else. So then a number of days later, one of my friends introduced him to me, so I had a chance to say hello to the younger Rabbi Nebenzahl of Sa'ir, as they call him. The younger Rabbi Nebenzahl, a very learned fellow. But this is, the nature of rabbinic succession is very complex. Who will succeed Rabbi Eliashiv? I have no idea in that world. And the way it usually happens is scholarship, honestly. Scholarship, and that kind of scholarship too, I mean, we're going to have it in the Sephardi world someday soon. Rabbi Avadi Yosef is a leader in the Sephardi world. And you see this happening right now in the Shas party. Shas party is his party. It it's the party that's led by this rabbi. But the rabbi is actually one of the great scholars of the 20th century. He's a character. He's also showing his years. I heard him a few weeks ago, the night before Yom Kippur. I went to Slichot, the Sfardi Slichot of the Kotel. There were probably 100,000 people there. I never saw so many people. And he led the spoken parts of the service. It was excellent. And then he led. And, you know, he's elderly. He's well into his 80s, I believe. If not 90, maybe he's 90. Probably that old. But the succession will be difficult because the reason he has so much power, and what Kirshenbaum said in his article, is that it's scholarship and charisma. There are issues of scholarship and charisma. And, you know, I don't know how you measure those things. I've never been able to figure them out. I can't figure it out now. The more I learn, the less I know. I don't really know how you figure out scholarship and charisma, but you know it when you see it. And the community eventually decides.
To the question I didn't know the answer before, I don't know if I say it right, Aser lecha chaver v'kneh lecha rav, or kneh lecha chaver v'aser lecha rav?
Kneh lecha chaver v'aser lecha rav.
So you don't get ravs by nepotism.
You're reading into it more than it says. It doesn't say that. Aser lecha rav, that means that you... It doesn't mean the appointment of a rabbi, but it means that you need to find for yourself somebody who is a rabbinic authority. That's all it means. Okay? Good. Let's keep going.
There's 23 men in a row agreeing, not arguing about who's in the second seat.
I think the new Shabbos, you know, it was a method of learning together.
Yeah. Once you're in the group, you know, the group knows how it functions. Okay. Now, these issues of succession, the nature of choosing leadership, which we've just been through in the democratic process, I commend for your reading Cicero's Republic as well as Plato's Republic. In both those classic statements of the nature of government, both Plato and Cicero, they have 350 years between them or so, really focus on three types of government. One is the government of the king, the other is the government of the aristocracy, and the other is a democracy. And it is in neither Plato nor Cicero is in favor of democracy. And they're not stupid people. They understand the problems of democracy is not a great system. Not a great system. I mean, it's a good system. There are a lot of pluses. But the issues involved and the positive issues involved, reasons why it's not so crazy to have a monarchy, the way in which cultures are kept together by monarchies, are something to be reckoned with. Those are classic discussions. So if you're interested in the subject, go back to the sources. Plato and Cicero are, to my mind, the best of the sources. Okay. The Gemara now. This is the Gemara about the Mishnah we just read. Mina hani milei. And I'm reading now the Rashi. From where do we know these things in the Mishnah? And the Rashi says, that they would sit in a circle. Of course, it's a semicircle. But now realize the methodology here. We have seen several times, efforts to find scriptural sources for something, a concept of the Mishnah. Okay? And if you remember the Mishnah itself told us why they sat in a circle. You remember why? It was so that they would see each other.
Yeah.
Okay? So, in a way, you don't need anything beyond that. The Mishnah itself gave you the reason. It's a perfect reason why, and we discussed that last week, you know, the values or the problems of looking at other people. Okay? So, the Mishnah said, but when you have the Gemara then come and say, Minahari Milei, it's as if there is a scriptural source for this, you should be immediately tipped off to the fact, or suspect the fact, that they're going to find a scriptural source, not because they've learned it from that source, but because this is their predilection. They had a reasonable way of going about things. They themselves told us what the reason was, but they're not satisfied with that. They always want to base it on something in the scriptures. But one shouldn't exaggerate the significance of that, whatever verses they will find, in actually achieving the idea that they have. Okay? Okay, Minahani Milei, Amar Rabbi Acha Bar Chanina. Rabbi Acha Bar Chanina gives you a scriptural source. The Amakra, because the Bible says, Shararech Adam Hasahar Al Yechsar Hamazek. This is a verse that he quotes from the Song of Songs. Now, I'm going to read you the English translation in the new JPS. It goes like this. Your navel is like a round goblet. Let mixed wine not be lacking. Can I explain to you? Do I need to explain to you what this is saying? This is erotic poetry. This is the man saying to his beloved woman, being on your navel, I want to drink it all up. Okay? This is the source of the circle that the Sanhedrin sits in a circle. Sure, it's the source. That's some source. Certainly doesn't mean that. And to cite a source like that is just beyond belief. Beyond belief. Okay? Now here, he then goes in, this is Rabbi Acha Bar Chanina, then parses the verse to show you exactly how he derives this. Shararech, your navel, Zo Sanhedrin. That refers to the Sanhedrin. Oh, obviously. The navel refers to the Sanhedrin. Let's see if Rashi says here. Well, we have to get to that yet. Okay, Shararech Zo Sanhedrin. Lama Nikra Shema Shararech. Why is the Sanhedrin called the navel? Shehi Yoshevet B'Tiburo Shel Olam. Because it sits at the navel of the world. Now that's already a very interesting concept here. Very interesting concept. The idea of the world having a center to it, where of course the navel nourishes the fetus, that is understood to be the Temple Mount. In the Midrash, all of spiritual reality is focused on one spot in Yerushalayim, on the Temple Mount itself. And then the rock, which today is in the Dome of the Rock, is the place of the Holy of Holies of the Temple. That is the holiest place in the world, and all of the spiritual energy of the entire universe is focused on that one place. Therefore, it is called Tiburo Shel Olam, the navel of the world. Now, Rashi, in his comment here, Tiburo Shel Olam, Shebet HaMikdash BeEmsa'o Shel Olam. The temple is in the middle of the world. Okay, that's a better way to say it. It's in the center of gravity, right? And of course, as you said before, the Sanhedrin sits in the Lishkata Gazit, in the office of hewn stone, so it was called, on the Temple Mount. So to some extent, what you have here is just the physical reality that the Sanhedrin itself is located and must be located on the Temple Mount. But I think that there's an overlay to this, and that is to say that the Sanhedrin, the large Sanhedrin now, 71, is so significant that it must be in the center of the world. It has to be. It cannot meet anywhere but in that center of spiritual power, which is in the Beit HaMikdash itself, in the temple itself. Okay? So in a way, I think that what this is saying about the Sanhedrin, it's in a way starting with shape, but it's going from shape to give us a sense of the divine nature of the court by its location. By its location. Okay?
And Islam took it to Medina. To Mecca for the Hajj, because the Hajj is situated around
the Black Rock.
Or whatever.
Kaaba, right.
And to fulfill the Hajj,
you have to go
circularly, they say very fancy words, seven times.
Right.
And it's truly the same concept of the center of your devotion. It's amazing parallelism.
Much of Islam picks up on these things in classical Judaism. An interesting thing about Islam is that interesting thing about Islam. What's his name? The Harvard professor that we have here, 2 or 3 years.
Kugel?
No, not Kugel.
Trigate? No, he's in Princeton.
I had him on a radio program 2 weeks ago. Just published a book on Abraham.
John Levinson.
When he spoke here, we asked him to speak the Lucy Davidovich lecture he gave on Judaism and Islam. It focused on several things, but the Akedah was the particular one. He just wrote this whole book now. Partly coming from his experience lecturing in Orzarua and other places on the subject. But one of the things that he points out in the book is that it's J-O-N, John Levinson. L-E-V-E-N-S-O-N. John Levinson, he points out in the book that I've lost my train of thought.
About
Akedah. What you're saying. That Islam, when Islamists developed some of the ideas in Islam, they developed them not, it's not as if they borrow from the Bible, but they borrow from the Midrash.
Yes.
They knew the Midrash. Because the Midrash was sort of the folk knowledge of the Jews. And many of the ideas, for example, the story of Abraham that he's focusing on, which is that Abraham was the first monotheist. That's the story of Abraham in the Quran is about Abraham as the champion of monotheism. Okay? And we Jews know that that's what we believe. However, if you read it in the Bible, it's not in the Bible. It's not in the Torah. We just finished reading that the last 2 weeks. There's nothing about that in the Torah at all. And many Jews are amazed when you tell them that this is not true. You're the lying. But if you read the Torah says nothing about Abraham. Yes, he's the first Jew, but the first monotheist, there's no indication of that whatsoever. In the first parsha that we read 2 weeks ago, Lech Lecha, and Melchizedek also is a monotheist. There's no indication of polytheism there whatsoever. None at all in the Bible. what Islam does is that Islam borrows the Midrashic idea. By the time of the rabbis, that's their Abraham. Their Abraham was this one who battled the idols, and his father was an idol maker. That's in the Midrash. It's not in the Bible at all. But it's so much in the Jewish mind that we think that that's what the Bible says. The Muslims also thought that they heard those stories too. And when they finally, you know, in the revelation of Muhammad, that's the Abraham that they have. That's the Abraham that they have. It's fascinating. Very, yes, the 7th century. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay, so we see then how the navel, in its own way, in its midrashic way, really conveys the profound significance of the Sanhedrin because of its location. Agam shehi migina al kol aulam kulo. Remember it said here, shrarech agam. Your navel is, agam is a basin. Agam is a basin. But what the rabbis do in the Midrash, and you have it here, the kind of homiletics that they use, is that the word agam is like the Hebrew word magen. It's like the word magen. It means a basin, all right? But Hebrew, you know, it could mean a lot of things. That's the nature of Hebrew. Hebrew is a fluid language, right? Based on consonants. And sometimes you have two consonants, sometimes you have three, sometimes you have four, and it's very fluid that way. So the interpretation is, agan shehim migina al kol ha'olam kulo. When it uses the phrase agan, which we translate literally as a basin, or the new translation was the goblet. It's a goblet, okay? It's a holder of something. Really what it's referring to is protection, because the Sanhedrin protects the whole world. But there again, you have a statement of the importance of the Sanhedrin. A high court really is the preserving force of the world. Without a court, you cannot have a society of justice. And therefore, that is the purpose of the Sanhedrin. Hasa'ar, right, it said that is like a round goblet. Sahar, Sahar is the Aramaic word for moon, yarech. Okay? That's the Aramaic for yarech. And it sneaks into Hebrew, okay? And here Sahar is used to refer to the rhinoceros. Right, it's crescent. And either it can be just the moon in general, but the commentators also point out here that a crescent moon is actually a better image. It's really a better image for the Sanhedrin because it's a semicircle. And a semicircle is really what we're talking about here. So the Sahar fits very nicely. Okay, then, now it just goes on. Al yasar amazeg, the verse says, let not the strength of the blend diminish. She'im hutzrach echad mehem latzeit, if one of the judges needs to leave, ro'im im yesh esrim u'shlosha keneged Sanhedrin katana yotze. This, again, is Midrash. This is not a discussion of halacha. This is simply taking this verse and parsing the verse. So another issue, which is tangential to this discussion, but which we just had in the Mishnah, was of judges going out, right? Or of missing a judge.
Or lives in the middle.
So here, this is a case of a judge who lives in the middle. Right?
That's a capital call. That's a capital case.
What's a capital case?
It's a capital case.
Correct, correct. So
a judge, case up and go?
Well, we don't know that they're talking about, in this Midrash, we don't know that they're talking about the court of 70, of 23. Because until this point, in the parsing of the verse, we've been referring to the Sanhedrin that's on the Temple Mount. And that's a court of 71. So it's really not exactly clear what they're referring to here, but I think they're referring to the court of 71. That's the way Rashi understands it. They're referring to the court of 71. And if people will leave that court, right, at what point does the court cease functioning? Right, the person has to go to the bathroom. Right, at what point do we say the court has got to declare a recess? Right, here it is, if one of them has to go out. Right. Im yesh esrim u'shlosha k'neged Sanhedrin katana yotzei. If left, after that one goes out, there's still 23 left, then it's okay for him to go out. The im lav eino yotzei. But if you don't have 23 left, then he's not allowed to leave. So you always have to have a minimum of 23 people at any one point in time in order for the session to still be in session. Okay?
Is that 23 after you've pulled in disciples to replace...
Excuse me, no, this has nothing to do with the disciples. This is changing the subject. This is not the same subject we were just discussing.
This is in session, that is how many was minimum of 23.
Right, this is now the Sanhedrin of 71. Right? And we don't know, really, whether you have rows in front to replace those people. Because we've been talking about the Sanhedrin of 23. Right.
So the backups were for the 23, not for the
71. The backups are the 23 and not for the 71. They can add up, if you add 2 and 2 and 2, that court of 23 can get as large as 71, but that's not the same as the court of 71 that sits on the Temple Mount.
Yeah, which is the original Senate.
Okay, that's the original Senate.
But you just need a third of them there?
For the court to continue to be in session.
A quorum is 23.
Well, not a quorum, because it wouldn't make sense for it to be a quorum, because you can't decide anything. You can't decide anything with that number. But again, this is not a halachic discussion. I want to emphasize that. There are no halachic ramifications of what we are reading now. Okay? I think that what you are reading now is simply an attempt to first of all find some reasonable statement in the scriptures which has absolutely nothing to do with what it's talking about. It's an erotic statement of the Song of Songs which is used in order to show the importance and the centrality of the Sanhedrin. That's, I think, what its significant meaning is. This last piece is not connected to that, frankly. And I'm not sure even the way that I am interpreting it, which is according to the Rashi, is correct. Because I don't think it makes sense. Because all of these problems are raised. But they're never dealt with. They're never dealt with because it's not an issue of halacha. It's not a halachic issue. Okay? It is simply the parsing of a verse. So I wouldn't go too far with it. I wouldn't get too hung up on it. Okay, let's go over to the next page. It's not finished yet. The next verse that follows the Song of Songs is Bitnech Aremat Chitin. Your stomach is like a heap of wheat. It's meant compliment. It's a compliment. And here it goes on. Ma Aremat Chitin Hakol Nehenimin Menu. As a heap of wheat, everyone enjoys. Also, it is true for the Sanhedrin that everyone derives benefit from it. Okay? Now, the last piece of the verse is Suga b'shoshanim, hedged with roses. Hedged with roses. Sheafilu kesuga shel shoshanim lo yifritzu bahem pratzot. That Israel, Efilu kesuga shel shoshanim, even if it is literally a fence
made of
roses, people will not break through it. People will not break through it. Now, let me explain what this is talking about. And in fact, I don't think that I really want to go any further with this. Let me explain it, because I want to pick up with this, because I just find the next paragraph to be so interesting. There is a concept in the halacha of the extent to which we need to provide a siyag lahalacha. Siyag is a fence around the law. A fence around the law. And a siyag is a fence. Okay? There's another possible interpretation. And that is that siyag can be understood as Aramaic. In Aramaic, for example, and you have this used a little bit in modern Hebrew, but it's used mostly in Aramaic, sagi nahor. Do you know what sagi nahor means? That's the way you say in Aramaic, blind person. Sagi nahor. Nahor means light. Sagi means filled with. So the way you say that somebody is blind is that they're filled with light. It's frequently in Aramaic, and you have this in Hebrew also, you never say something that is troubling. You say the opposite of it. It's an inverse, right. So the way you say somebody is blind is that they're filled with light. Okay, sagi nahor. It's a fascinating thing in Aramaic. And that's the way that Talmud deals with many of these issues. So sagi in Aramaic means male in Hebrew, male. So their siyag may also be a filling on something, the way something is filled. But a siyag means creating a fence. The laws of the Sabbath, for example, are filled with fences. Filled with fences. I'll give you an example. Why is it prohibited to carry money on the Sabbath?
So that you're not tempted to use it.
Why can't you use it?
Because you do it on the Mechol. You don't do certain function of the certain Melachol.
That's possible.
So if you do purchasing through the Mechol, you don't do it on Shabbat.
And where does it prohibit you to do things that are done on a regular day on the Sabbath? There is a verse in Isaiah that does say that. But much of the law of the Sabbath is siyag la-Torah. It's a fence around the law. It's a fence around the law. Many things we don't do. You will notice it is very, in the laws of modesty, for example. People who are careful about the laws of modesty, it's an issue today. It's an interesting issue. It's even an issue in the conservative rabbinate. The extent to which people should touch each other. Is it permissible? Should people touch each other? It's a very interesting issue. The issue is classically framed as men touching women. Okay, and it's prohibited for men to touch women. Why? Nothing wrong with touching. There's nothing wrong with you can. Because it's a siyag la-Torah. It is a fence around the law. It's a fence around the law. So, much of the law is fences. But the question sometimes arises, to what extent do you always have to have a fence? Or can you have a fence to a fence? And that's an important question, because that's what's going on in the Jewish community today. The Jewish community today is involved in many parts of the community in creating all kinds of fences.
Buses for men only.
You could have buses for men only. Well, there would be a bus for, as a result of that, a bus for women.
No, they stay home.
It's another possibility. You like this idea?
I will be the first one to send them to Palestine, the old all those people.
Oh, the old Palestine, okay. So, this is very popular in modern Judaism, is to create a fence around the fence. The concept here is that there is a fence of roses. Fence of roses. And that is to say that it is on the one hand an easy fence to push aside. On the other hand, roses, if you've ever pushed roses, they have thorns. So it's a very interesting image to use in terms of the law. We normally think of the law as, you know, really rigid fences. But this is a very interesting fence, which on the one hand is pliable, on the one hand it's, on the other hand it's dangerous. All right, you can actually get hurt when you do it. Such that that image, then, is a classic image that is used in the laws of sexuality. And in the context that is going to come up here, the context is one of which, whom can a man be alone with? And as a result of that, we do not suspect the possibility that he will violate a law of the Torah. Okay? With whom can a man be alone? Because we assume that, or it is possible to assume, that there are many laws of the Torah that could be violated. I had a teacher, for example, who was very careful. And if I told you who this teacher was, you would have a very interesting connection to him. I'm not going to tell you. he always said to us the following. He said, boys, because we were only boys, there were no women, and in those days you didn't, in the way you would treat your students, as you called them boys. He said to us, boys, never close your door. You should never be alone with a woman. It was interesting. And we used to discuss this, whether this was a problem. Normally, it's not usually a problem. The reality is, yesterday, I read the case of one of my students, who was a rabbi, who was thrown out of the rabbinical assembly because he fooled around with women from his congregation. I had no idea.
He didn't do it with the door open?
He didn't do it with the door open.
Who squealed?
Well,
he had the door closed.
But these are live issues, and the truth is that the issue of sexual harassment is an extremely live issue today. It is a major issue, and is a major issue as far as the relation of men and women go, particularly men harassing women, but it also functions the reverse. The reverse is also possible. And today, because of changing sexual standards, it's also true as far as same-sex relationships go, similarly. So sexual harassment is across the board a major issue, and we know that in our society. So the question is, what relationships are relationships that there should be fences around, and what relationships can we assume there need be no fences around? Okay?
Babbling, that's the only one.
Absolutely true. Frequently manifests itself that way, but it's... Okay. And one of the very interesting contexts is parents and children. Can parents and children be together, alone? And that is the ramification of the law, because that's in the most personal way, because the Torah itself forbids sexual relations within the family. So if the Torah forbids it, should we then say that the rabbis should create a fence around it so that a father and a child cannot be in the same room together? And I don't necessarily mean a father and a male child or a female child. It doesn't make any difference. Those are all prohibitions of the Torah. Okay? To answer that, you have to come back next time.
Thank you.